Evening. Red Velvet Underground, glad you can make it.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's San Francisco, 1969. We're in a small club called The Family Dog, and the band, called The Velvet Underground, destined to become one of the most influential in rock and roll, can't even fill the place. This is a recording made by a young fan, Robert Quine. It's part of a new bootleg box set. Lots of fans took tape recorders to Velvet Underground concerts, partly because you couldn't hear the band on the radio, and partly because those who liked the band loved it. The Velvets were intimately tied to a jaded downtown New York scene centered around Andy Warhol's factory. But here, late in their short career, here in San Francisco, where peace and love predominated, they were playing to the few, the loyal. Hey, White Boy, sang Lou Reed. What you doing uptown? It wasn't just a song about scoring some H in Harlem. In the simplest language, Reed was singing about everyday things that most other artists decorated over top of or talked around. And the music, for those who discovered it, as an alternative to the San Francisco hippie onslaught of the Grateful Dead, knew they'd found something just right. Something dark, sexy, adventurous, unheard of. The Velvet Underground is still revered, although you won't see them making appearances on MTV or doing celebrity promos for your local radio station. Connection listeners, what was it that the Velvets brought to rock in its teenage years? How does the music and the scene they came to embody remain both avant-garde and hugely influential today? To borrow the words of one of our upcoming guests, the revolution continues. Join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online. We're at theconnection.org. We'll be speaking in just a couple of moments with band members Mo Tucker, the drummer, Doug Yule, the bassist, and we've also got David Frick standing by, senior editor of Rolling Stone. But we're going to go first to Lisa Robinson. Lisa is now a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, but Lisa, in the mid-1960s, you were one of those people who discovered the Velvet Underground, am I right?
Well, yeah, it was a little later than the mid-1960s. It was sort of towards the end of the 1960s, but New York at that time was a very different place, certainly, than California or the rest of the country. You know, it was the lines of demarcation were very strongly drawn. The people who liked Little Richard versus Pat Boone, you know, the Rolling Stones instead of the Beatles, and Andy Warhol's scene and the Velvets playing at the Dom drew the same kind of people. Like myself, I snuck out of the house as a kid to go see Thelonious Monk. I listened to Lenny Bruce records. You know, all of that was more influential to us at the time than the Beatles were. And Lou Reed was certainly writing about stuff that the bands coming out of Haight-Ashbury or the Doors or any other rock bands were writing about. He was writing about drugs and death, and it was infinitely more glamorous and compelling and sexier and darker than anything else. And just the sound of John Cale's viola screeching and Moe's drums, kind of that heavy tom-tom beat, it was just didn't sound like anything else. And it was possible to have a scene then. There wasn't this glut of media that there is today. And I don't know that we all felt we were part of a jaded downtown New York scene, but it certainly was a very passionate small group of people that did discover this.
So to be a part of the Velvet Underground scene, does that mean that you weren't a part of the hippie scene?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Lou Reed and John Cale in particular were very, very disdainful of hippies. They always, you know, just, and Andy Warhol also, that whole group, it was just not something that was really part of anybody's consciousness. They looked down on it.
We've got, as I said, David Frick on the line. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Lisa's describing, though, that you kind of had to make a choice back then. Is it something that you recall?
Actually, since I didn't come from New York or from San Francisco, I lived in Philadelphia. And one of the things that struck me is that I didn't find any trouble reconciling either of those. The one thing that I think now in retrospect is that San Francisco represented a kind of dizzy utopia. You know, everything's free, everything's groovy, and that has a lot to do with probably baking out in the sun a lot. But in New York, obviously, a lot more shadows, a lot more darkness. But the one thing about the Velvets that always made me love them to death was that I never thought of them as jaded or of the songs as being, you know, negative. I thought of it really almost as a kind of focused joy, almost like serious exuberance, because there was so much energy and so much thunder and lightning in the sound, and yet the words were very direct. They spoke of things without a lot of evasion. You know, he was talking about sexual deviance, he was talking about drug use, but not talking about them in an exploitative way, but as a fact of life, as they are for many people. And what I found they were, between Velvets and the Airplane and the Dead and Quicksilver in San Francisco, I thought of them as really two sides of the same coin. It was really, they were part of a general awakening in the country that if you weren't in New York and you weren't in San Francisco, I didn't see there was a problem. And in a way, that was one of the reasons why I came to love them so much, is that for all of their disdain of San Francisco, once they got to San Francisco and played the shows in this box set, you can hear them, you know, picking up some of the guitar raga stuff. You know, Sterling himself once told me that one of his favorite bands was Quicksilver Messenger Service.
One of Andy Warhol's favorite from that time was the song All Tomorrow's Parties. Let's just listen to a bit of it here. Lisa Robinson, I can see the tall, blonde head of Nico performing with Warhol's movies as I listen to that. How much for you was the Velvet Underground completely a part of the factory, and could you separate them out just as a band?
Well, first of all, the main thing I'm thinking hearing this is how great it still sounds. You know, when something is really good, it's just timeless, and it still sounds so modern and so strong. I wasn't hanging around the factory that much, so I don't know. It was a little before my time, but obviously Andy picked up on this band, and they were very much a part of the whole sort of cultural scene that was happening at that time. It went along with the movies that he was making, and they were just sort of the soundtrack to that. You know, I do think that there was, David's right, there was a lot of joy about it. It wasn't like everybody was sitting around, you know, contemplating suicide or anything, listening to this music. It was very much a part of that scene. It was a discovery. It was people getting out of their houses, you know, just, it wasn't a conscious rebellion. It was just something that sounded right. And if you wanted to go and see any of those movies, or you listened to that music, or you went to see them at the Dome, I mean, remember also, Jackson Brown performed with Nico at the Dome, and Bob Dylan was very much not a part of necessarily that scene, but he came around the factory a lot, as did the Rolling Stones, and it was a total general awakening. That's completely correct. And the Velvets, I think, just not only were the soundtrack to the factory and those movies in that time, but just to anybody who loves really great rock and roll over the past 30 years, it still sounds so great.
Lisa, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Lisa Robinson, a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, writes about music. We're joined on the line now by Doug Ewell, who was a bassist for the Velvet Underground, joined the group in 1968. Is that right, Doug?
Yeah, that's right.
So you would have seen the original members perform before you joined them?
Yeah, I first saw them at Harvard University in Cambridge, and they were without John that night, which was kind of prophetic, I guess. He was sick, but I remember being just really blown away by the intensity of the group, the almost a theatrical quality to the music.
I was reading in I think, one of David Frick's liner notes that at one point they were spending so much time in Boston that the Tea Party considered them a house band. Did people in Boston get a lot of exposure to the Velvet Underground, Doug?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. In fact, to the extent that from the rest of the country, we would always get asked if we were from Boston. People didn't realize for a long time that we were from New York, unless they were, you know, people who were in New York.
And I know you've probably told the story 101 times, but you were, what, 20, 21 years old when they said, "Hey, Doug, want to join the Velvet Underground?"
Yeah, I was 21. Do you want to hear this
whole
story?
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I was in Boston. I was working in another band, of which the managers were friends with the manager of the Velvets. And Sterling would stay at the apartment from time to time, and he heard me playing and heard that I was doing well and, you know, mentioned it to the rest of the group. And then one day I got a call out of the blue from Steve, who said, "Do you want to join the band?" And basically the two requirements were that I would be willing to switch from guitar to bass and that I was a Pisces, because they wanted to keep the group astrologically balanced. Pisces, Virgo, Pisces, Virgo.
I wouldn't have thought that would have been a priority with the Velvet Underground. But
no, it was.
Okay.
So I said yes, and that was it. It took, you know, 20 minutes, and then I drove to New York, and we played that following weekend in Cleveland.
Straight out on the road.
Right out. I mean, I spent a day and a half in Lou's loft just learning tunes, and then we went out to Cleveland and played.
David Frick, a lot of people know the Velvet Underground by their albums, perhaps fewer by their work on the road. You've listened to some of the bootleg tapes of that time. Was it a band that was able to take the same sound on the road?
One of the great things about the Velvet bootlegs that I have, both in this set that's just come out and also all the illicit ones that are out there that I have, is that they not only could take that sound out on the road, but that sound really grew and mutated literally from night to night. The improvisational quality of what they did and the different personalities, you know, John's thing was much different from what Doug brought. Doug brought something very different and very special in his way to the band after 1968. In fact, one of my favorite bootlegs is from October 68 when Doug first joined in Cleveland. It's really an amazing raw tape, and the fact that he could settle in that way and really go for it showed just what a great, fluid, exciting rock and roll band the Velvets were.
Connection listeners, did you ever have a chance to see the Velvet Underground on the road? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This is White Height. White Light, White Heat. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the band The Velvet Underground. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What Goes On is a song from the third album. This is The Velvets playing live in 1969, part of the newly released bootleg box set.
Thank you.
My guests are David Frick, senior editor of Rolling Stone, and Doug Ewell is with us. He was a bassist for the Velvet Underground. Doug, do you remember each club? Do you remember the different places being on the stage with the band?
Many of them, yeah. Some of them, no. But most of them, yeah. I remember specific shows, although they tend to blend together after, 25 or 30 years.
And the San Francisco recordings of Quine, do you have a recollection of that, of this guy holding up a microphone attached to a cassette recorder?
Well, he didn't actually hold it up, but yeah, I remember The Matrix real well and The Family Dog pretty well. The Matrix was a nice club because it was real small and it was long, and you were playing the short way, so that the sound came back real fast in your face. But it was very intimate. It was close, so it was a nice place to play because you could kind of feel, that kind of closeness of a small club.
You try and bring a recorder into a concert now, you're frisked, it's taken away. Back then, was it something that, as a band, you welcomed, you paid attention to?
No, it was generally frowned on, and people would, if they were obvious about it, they'd be, taken out. But it wasn't as strict as it is now, as quite as security conscious.
So this Robert Quine, who has, hours and hours, was it because he became a friend of the band that he was allowed to do that?
I don't know.
Just weren't paying attention, were you?
Yeah, I had other things on my mind at the time. But, at The Matrix, they also recorded house tapes because they had a reel-to-reel machine,
right,
and a little sound booth. And those were released on the 69 album, Live 69.
David Frick, the Brian Eno quote that everyone who ever went to hear the Velvet Underground went back and started their own band. After, I haven't got it right, but that's the thrust of it.
That's pretty much the gist of it, yeah.
Why?
Well, it's the thing about the Velvets, and I think this was more true of them than, say, of other popular bands today, like the Airplane and the Dead and a lot of the stuff going on the West Coast and the Doors, is that, they inspired something more than just dancing, doing LSD, free love. They were completely separate from basically the cliches of the day. And I think that the fact that they were artists, Lou as a songwriter was clearly influenced by something other than simply the beat poets. He was talking about people like James Joyce, Hubert Selby Jr. His interest in songwriting really came from literature. Sterling, too, was a very acute mind. He, too, was, he studied literature after he left the Velvets. He went on to doctoral studies. Everyone in the band really was focused on the music as a form of art, as well as fun and as something to dance to. And I think that the people that cottoned on to that took that as an inspiration. It was not merely entertainment. And also, the kind of people they drew, I think, tended to be seekers. They tended to be inquisitive, and I think they felt that this was something that could be taken further. Remember, the Velvets, as a band, broke up in 1970. So, and there were, everyone has since gone on to do other things, and, that's when Lou left the band. But, after that period, there was so much still to drink in from those four records, but really not enough to be what you would call a career the way, say, the Stones have one now. So in order to hear this music again, you kind of had to make it yourself.
But there was something playable about it, too.
Extremely playable. The chord sequences are actually quite straightforward. There's not a lot of noodling. It's not a real Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page type thing. And yet there's a lot of ferocity in it. One of my favorite Velvets bootleg tapes is from the Boston Tea Party. It's the notorious guitar amp tape in which a guy actually, his microphone was literally in front of Lou's amp. So that really what you get is a lot of distortion and feedback. I personally think that's a fun thing. But, you really get a sense of the intensity of the guitar playing was in that band and the physical force of it, so that, you could really be physically moved by that sound, by that music. And, I still feel that way whenever I listen to any of the Velvets recordings I have.
Our number's 1-800. Sorry, go ahead, Doug.
There's also another side to Lou that people often miss. There's the art side, the poet side, which is involved in his words. But he also, and Sterling had this also, a real talent for melody. And it was based in, as it was for all of us, in the rock and roll of the 50s and the early 60s, the real, you know, doo-wop singers and real basic Chuck Berry kind of rock and roll. And Lou is really good at putting together a melody that was extremely simple and yet very memorable and very intense, you know. And to wit, my favorite example is the guitar solo on What Goes On, which I personally re-record yearly just for my own satisfaction. But this other side of him, I think, is one of the reasons why the group had a lot of impact.
Like Sweet Jane from Loaded.
Exactly. I mean, you can't get much more basic.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand, Jackson's corset, Jane is in her vest, and me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Huh. Riding a Stutz Bearcat, Jim, you know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes.
You're right, Doug, that guy could write. I mean, that one made the charts, but could you have done a dozen of those and been huge?
In the right situation, yeah, I think so. There's his songs have a universality, a kind of an accessibility that's... it's real basic. If it's presented right, you know, it's very, it can work.
And when they come home from work, ooh, sitting down by the fire, the radio does play the classical music there, Jim. The march of the wooden soldiers, all your protest kids, you can hear Jack say, get rid of here.
And yet there's an edge, David Frick, to the lyrics. This is not the Turtles singing Happy Together, you know?
No, there's not a whole lot of Happy Together in these songs, but Doug is actually very right, and that's actually a great point, is that the essence of melody in those songs means that, you know, when people were influenced by the Velvets, they didn't replicate the sound necessarily. You could, you know, turn the guitar up, go full blast with the feedback. That's what the Stooges did. That's what the MC5 did. But when you listen to a lot of covers of Velvet songs from the entire, you know, span of those original four records, REM, Nirvana, you know, so many people do these songs, and yet they can find their own way into them. The Cowboy Junkies did a really beautiful, beautiful version of Sweet Jane that sounds, it literally was recorded in a church, just very soft vocal, very
soft
guitar.
It's the Trinity Sessions, right?
The Trinity Sessions.
Yeah.
And, you know, the malleability of those songs is really a tribute to Lou's gift as a melody writer, Sterling's gift as a supportive guitarist, and generally the band's ability in both of the incarnations to have melody and force at the same time. And there wasn't like, here's a melody song, here's a force song. It was really an indivisible thing, and that was among the many things that really made them special.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, and to Needham, Massachusetts. Payson, you're on The Connection. Hi.
Good morning. My name is Payson, and back then I worked for the guys that ran the light shows at the Boston Tea Party. I wanted to ask Doug if he remembered going out to Western Massachusetts to open up a club called the Woodrose Ballroom.
Oh, yeah, I remember that well.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
The guys I worked with rented one of those old hullabaloo roller skating rinks out near Amherst and tried to turn it into a rock and roll club. I guess it lasted about a year, but the Velvets were so gracious to come out and kick off the opening weekend along with Peter Wolf and his band at the time also. But the Velvets used to pack the tea party on Berkeley,
Payson, that was over 30 years ago.
Well,
tell me why.
69. You know, I had my Tandberg tape recorder in there, and you guys were probably the only group I didn't record. I've got...
And don't you wish you had.
Yeah. I have the largest unreleased catalog of Jay Giles tapes in the world, probably, as well as a few other bands.
But I was asking you about the time span, because I want you to tell me, Payson, what it is about the group that sticks in your mind.
We were so busy running lights. The music was just all-encompassing. And we created from what they were creating, we created on the walls.
Yeah, there was no computer sync up.
No. This was all manual labor. In fact, we were mixing three different colors of with different kinds of dyes, and to get what we needed to affect a real atmosphere that people would enjoy. There's never been another place in Boston like that.
Doug Yule, when you think back to that kind of work that Payson was doing and what happened when you were on the road, were you thinking of yourself as a traveling art show or as a band on the road?
Just a band on the road. I mean, that's what we were. We were a band on the road.
Payson, thank you for your call. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Lexington, Marina, you're on The Connection. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thanks.
I remember seeing the Velvet Underground in a defunct airport, either in West Brookfield, Massachusetts, or Leicester, Massachusetts. I was growing up in Worcester at the time, and I still don't know exactly when it was or which airport it was, but it was an airport. And we
you don't have to explain that lapse in memory.
And all I remember is that we all wanted to look like Nyko. And we, of course, we didn't. But it was just an amazing experience. They were an amazing band. And
what made them different, Marina? What was it?
The darkness. The fact that the kind of monotonal. They were just powerful. They were just powerful. And the other day, I was talking to my daughter, who has the Almost Famous soundtrack, and David Bowie does Waiting for the Man. And I said, that's not the right version, you know, so I played her the Lou Reed version. And I still have the record with the peel, the banana peel on the front.
Does it still stick on when you take it off?
It sure does.
Amazing.
Anyway, it was wonderful, and it's a great program. And we never called them the Velvets. We always referred to them as the Velvet Underground.
I take that. Thank you for your call, Marina.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
David Frick. People are talking about that darkness. Lisa brought it up. Marina's talking about it. What was the appeal of that? Can you take us back to that time?
Well, I think when you're young, there's a lot of darkness in your life. That really accounts for a lot of what happened with alternative rock, grunge, so to speak, in the 90s. A lot of hardcore rap, a lot of hardcore metal, Metallica, bands like that. You know, when you're young, darkness is something you're really coming to grips with. You're coming out of childhood, a lot of the naivety. You're dealing with more direct issues of sexuality, what you're going to do with your life, trying to make a connection with another person, man, woman, whatever. And you just start thinking about things that just aren't fun. And what the Velvets did was they addressed that directly. Well, I'll say the Velvet Underground. Apparently the Velvets is not politically correct anymore.
No, we always called it the Velvets.
Okay.
Well, we'll take Doug's approval, then we're fine.
Yes, definitely. But I think that, you know, that was something that appealed to me. I didn't have a particularly dark childhood, but to hear about these things in a way that simply wasn't in a textbook in school or something that I was reading, you know, as required college literature, it was something that spoke a lot more directly to me than necessarily reading Crime and Punishment. I eventually got into that, but to hear it first in a 3-minute and a 4-minute song with guitars, that was closer to my language than something from the 19th century.
Can I tell you a story?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Doug.
This was before my time, but I heard it from the source. And it was when the band was first starting, they played a little underground place in the village. And the first time, I think it was Heroin, they did it. And the club owner came around and said, if you guys play that again, you're fired. So, of course, the next set, Lou opens with the same song again, and they got fired. But I think that essence is inside the music, that what are we not supposed to do? Let's explore that. Who, you know,
you can't
what is
fire
the,
me, I quit, sort of thing.
Right, yeah, you know, like, wait a minute, you know. And I think that for young people, that at least for me, that was a very pertinent sort of attitude in those times.
But on the stage, in the green room, you know, were you guys having fun, or were you fancying yourselves as dark?
Oh, no, having fun, definitely. I mean, it was a rock and roll band, you know, and this was still rock and roll as was sort of laid down by Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and Little Richard. You know, this is like rock and roll. You know, it was New York rock and roll, but it was music to, you know, that was fun. It was current, but it was fun.
Do you have any recollection of the song Oh Sweet Nothing, Doug?
Oh, yeah.
Is it a favorite? I mean, this is you singing,
you know,
right?
Yeah, it's me singing. I never liked my voice on that song. I just don't think I don't have a real strong voice. It's kind of, you know, sweet, you know, I don't know. But it was a...
You got to look at the pictures of a 21-year-old Doug Ewell. You were a sweet kid. What can you say?
Yeah, well, those were the days.
Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the Velvet Underground. We're interested in your anecdotes, your ideas about why that music has endured the way that it has. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
And say a word for Ginger Brown. Walks with his head down to the ground. Took the shoes right off his feet. Threw the poor boy right out in the street. And this is what he said.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the enduring legacy of the band The Velvet Underground in a new box set, the Bootleg Series Volume 1, The Quine Tapes. My guests are the band member Doug Ewell and Rolling Stone senior editor David Frick. The number to join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Right now you're hearing The Velvets on The Quine Tapes. This is live in San Francisco, November 1969. The song is Heroin. Up there for some strange reason. I don't know. 1-800-423-8255. And joining us on the line from Danvers, Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Well, I had to add my two bits to your show. I'd been a big Velvets fan in the late 70s, and even though I grew up in a small town in Lutz, Florida, MC Kostek and Phil Milstein were putting out these incredible Velvet Underground fanzines, and you know, you're part of the whole thing, and somebody had given me a tape of Nico in Milwaukee, and I thought, hey, I could put this on a piece of vinyl, which I did. We put out, started a little bootleg company. And then somebody had given us a tape from the Bataclan show in sort of a reunion concert in 1972. That ended up on vinyl, and we sort of went from there. But that was a long time ago, and hopefully the statute of limitations has gone by now. But I think it's great they finally released this stuff. And, you know, the best thing about these old Velvet Underground tapes is you don't have to clean them up at all. I mean, if you're a fan, it's like, you know, looking at the Venus de Milo or something, you can just sort of fill in the blanks. It doesn't matter if there's anything missing. It's just, you can't lose.
Tony, thanks for your call.
Take it easy.
Doug Ewell, at the time, I know this is a goofy question, but help me with it. At the time, did you have any kind of an idea that you were doing something important in music?
I don't think so. I mean, it was, from the inside, it was very different than it was, I guess, from the outside, and certainly much different than in hindsight. For us, it was like, and we used to say this periodically to each other, it was kind of amazing that we were doing something that we just would be doing anyway, we just loved to do, and people would, you know, actually pay us to come and do it. It was, for more than anything else, I think, a labor of love, you know, something that you were compelled to do.
I guess what I'm wondering is, at the time, you're going, man, look at how well the Beatles are doing and the Stones, and we're doing this really good music, and what? You know?
Well, yeah, it's hard to describe because to be at that age, at that time, rock and roll was really king. You know, music was the cutting edge. It was where the social comment was being done, which it isn't anymore. And so a lot of people were sort of pushing the envelope out. And in that aspect, it was, I guess, you were doing something. You know, this was where it was happening. This was where the center of the universe was at this point. And but it wasn't like we were, you know, it wasn't a situation where we said, well we're going to do something significant that'll be remembered down the years. You know, we were just doing what we were doing and loving it while we were doing it.
I should make a point to our listeners. We had hoped to have Mo Tucker with us, and Mo, if you're listening, pick up the phone. We're calling you here. But she's not right now. We hope to get her on before the end of the program. But we are going to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Paula is on the line. Hi, Paula.
Thanks for doing the show. This is great. I just sort of wanted to talk about the more modern legacy of the Stroke. I mean, I was the Velvet Underground with a band.
Oh, there was a slip.
The band that sort of burst onto the scene this year, well, in 2001, called the Strokes, often compared to the Velvet Underground because they're from New York, and I think topically the subject matter of their songs can be compared, but it's also the lead singer's vocals are really similar to Lou Reed's in many songs. But these guys are all in their early 20s. I mean, I'm in my early 30s, but it's sort of a quiet legacy, the Velvet Underground. You don't hear Velvet Underground songs on oldie stations, of which there are plenty of oldie stations. And so they were just sort of, they were the pre-indie, I mean, even before there was indie, they were indie. And the fact that this many years later, there's still so many influences, but they're sort of not the in-your-face kind of influences. They're quiet, and I don't know. It's just, it's really pretty amazing.
No, I mean, the Strokes come up whenever we got into a conversation about Velvet Underground. Let's have a listen to Modern Age. It's from their debut LP. David Frick from Rolling Stone, connect this band with Velvet Underground for us.
Well, I've seen the Strokes quite a bit, and I've written about them, and yes, there is a quality of Julian, the singer's voice, that you can say has a lot of Lou Reed in it. There's a very robotic quality to the rhythm and the guitars, but really, the fact is, they're from New York. It's hard not to have some Velvet Underground in you, but the other thing is that, as a band, you don't necessarily have to be deep in Velvet's lore to have, you know, build on it. A lot of the bands that I think that the Strokes can be compared to include The Fall, The Jam, Wire, and, you know, particularly Wire and The Fall, the British bands, they had a lot to do with being influenced by The Velvets. So it's really a continuum to say that The Strokes sound like The Velvets on this particular track. There's a lot of it, but that's the whole quality of having a good long life in music, is that you're not tied to a particular era, and that when someone comes along and does something that maybe sounds a bit like that, it's not like they're copying you. It's part of the atmosphere, and it's part of just the whole color and the history of the music. And I think that that's an element of growth and really the immortality of this, of the sound and the ideas.
But if you map it out, David, you can't. I mean, can you draw the same black lines between from the Stones to a band playing today? You know, from the Beatles, the way that
the lines are way too confused now, because as Doug pointed out, in the late 60s, there wasn't as much of what you have now in terms of bands, music, media, all the stuff that in a way threatens to cheapen the experience. You know, as someone who works in the media, it's a worry to me, because I think that a lot of the things that are most important about music can be the ones most easily lost when you're talking about heavy rotation on MTV and corporate sponsorship and, you know, is your ad in a Volkswagen, your music in a Volkswagen ad. What the Velvets really have as a band, as an entity, as a fact of history, you know, they've maintained a purity. You know, yes, there are re-releases. Yes, there are box sets. There's this bootleg thing. But I don't feel that it's been tainted. And I think that that's one of the reasons a band like The Strokes can take a little something of New York and take a little something of The Velvets and make it their own, is that it hasn't been turned into a commodity. It's actually impossible to turn The Velvets into a commodity, and that's the reason why they're still with us.
Yeah, it's interesting that when the band was active, they were commercially unsuccessful by almost any standard. I mean, we sold enough records to keep the record company, you know, making a few more, but
and to pay the rent for you guys, Doug?
Just barely. I mean, I never got paid while I was in the band. You know, my rent would get paid, but I never actually had like a paycheck or anything like that. It just didn't happen. It was just, there was enough money to keep touring and to keep making records, but it was commercially not successful.
Paula, thanks for your, I want to just
That's okay.
truck along here. Thank Paula for her call and go to Ari from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Ari.
Hey, interesting that you mentioned Wire. I keep hearing you refer to the Velvets as a rock and roll group. Surely they were also the first punk group?
David.
If there was such a thing as punk at that time, yes, they were. Although, actually, again, there was so much going on. There were, you know, you talk about the whole Nuggets garage band scene, which also has been described as punk. That was a phrase that Lenny Kaye used, Lester Bangs used back in the day. So punk as a form of music... there's a lot of gray areas in there, but certainly the Velvets were an enormous influence on punk rock in America as well as in Britain.
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It didn't start in 76, it started in 67 with the Velvets.
I would say that if you wanted to say that there was a ground zero for punk rock, that was probably it.
Were you listening to Velvet Underground, Ari, in Great Britain?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Though they never performed there, did they?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Doug?
but not with Lou.
Okay, so after Lou left the band.
Yeah, right after Lou left the band, yeah.
Mm. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. David, I'm puzzled and I'm a little bit intrigued.
There are many puzzling aspects to this story. I'm still puzzled, and I've been writing about it for a long time.
So how do you measure influence, though? Because you could measure influence by where they were in the charts. You could measure influence by how clean the line is from this group to that group 30 years later.
That's a difficult thing, because, you know, hey, you know, Roger Whittaker was on the charts. I don't see a lot of bands influenced by Roger Whittaker or Henry Mancini. You know, the charts thing is that's a quantitative measure of how much money you're making and how many people have bought your records. That is not a measure of how those records have impacted on people. One of the things that's interesting is that, you know, one of the places that the Velvets played a lot with John and with Doug was in Cleveland. And, you know, at Le Cave, and, you know, Chrissy Hynde from Ohio, big Velvets freak. Rick Ocasek from the Cars, he used to see the band there. And then you had a whole scene in Cleveland in the mid-70s with bands like Pere Ubu, Rocket from the Tombs, the Dead Boys. That is part of the strain. You know, when the Velvets went to Cleveland, they left something in the DNA. And that impact, you know, definitely grew. And it grew to the point where later on, you know, Chrissy Hynde did have hit records. And you can see some of Lou's songwriting, that stance, that attitude in what she did. You can't say that she sounds like the Velvets, but there's no question that she found something in the quality of the Velvets that, you know, really spoke to her and that she could turn into her own. And that's why we're talking about this now. If it was just a matter of hit records, then, you know, we'd be talking about, I don't know, the Cowsills. No disrespect to them, because they made some good pop records. But, you're talking about continuum. You're talking about an impact that is not measurable in numbers.
This is I should point out to our listeners, a new show. And this just in, an email from Mo Tucker. It reads, "Hi, Allison, Doug, David, Lisa. My phone has blown up. I noticed a phone truck a few houses down, went to ask them what was going on. The answer, it's tore up. Tried to email Allison, and you guessed it. The mail part of my server, different company than phone, is also, quote, experiencing problems." Life in, it's Georgia, I think, right? Life in Georgia. Hope you're having fun, from Mo. So what are you going to do? We'll say hi to her on the radio. And we will go out on our program today with a little bit more of the Quine tapes. Doug, just as you hear this in a couple of words, was this the best time of your life?
Certainly one of the best times. It was wonderful years, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Doug Ewell, thank you for being with us. David Frick, thank you for being with us. Earlier in the program, we talked with Lisa Robinson. And we'll listen to The Velvet Underground. This is The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon.